What do you mean, Joe? My name's Roy.
Well, come here, Roy, and get groovy. You been uptown?
No, I ain't been uptown, but I've been around.
You mean to say you ain't been uptown?
No, I ain't been uptown. What's uptown?
If it's pleasure you're about, and you feel like stepping out, all you've got to shout is, let me off uptown. If it's rhythm that you feel, then it's nothing to conceal. All you've got to spill is, let me off.
Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is James Gavin. He has written a number of critically acclaimed books about jazz and vocal artists, and tonight we're talking about his latest, Cool Heat, Anita O'Day and Her Dangerous Jazz Life. James, welcome to the show. It is such a pleasure to talk to you.
Mark, I love these conversations we have every few years.
Yeah, they're great.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me back.
Oh, it's a real pleasure, and this book is wild. Now, what brought you to write a biography of Anita O'Day? I mean, now that I've read your book, I know why, but how did you just sort of look into this?
It wasn't my idea. In 2022, my George Michael biography was out of my hands, soon to be published, and I was at loose ends, and out of the blue came an email from a man named Alan Shipton, the author of many books, British. He is a musician himself, and he edits a series of jazz books for Equinox Publishing, a British-based publisher. And he asked me, took me completely unawares, and said, would you like to write a book for us about Anita O'Day? And the subject was catnip for me, because I'd been a fan of hers since I was 8 or 9 years old. And then starting in the mid-80s, I began seeing her live and meeting her and meeting her and meeting her. I was in her company at least 25 times, I'd
say. Wow.
And while she never remembered me from meeting to meeting, she was very nice to me always. She wasn't always with other people.
Oh, yeah.
She was with me. She liked me for some reason. I think she knew that I was a sincere fan. I didn't want anything from her, and that I was fascinated by her. And so I unhesitatingly said yes to Alan Shipton, and I'm so happy it happened. I would never have thought to do it, because I would never have thought a publisher cared enough to have me write a whole book about Anita O'Day. She's a jazz legend, not exactly a household word, but she should be.
She should be. And your book really makes that case. She, as you write, she epitomizes what's been called, quote, the jazz life. I mean, she was even mentioned in Jack Kerouac's On the Road, as you write. This is all from your book. But I have to tell you, it was harrowing at times reading her biography. I mean, what a life. Yet she had this sort of finish that was nice. It was good. She was still ornery. But she was like,
yeah. Well, 60 Minutes profiled Anita in the early 1980s. Shortly after her memoirs, which I always loved, called High Times, Hard Times,
yep,
written with a biographer named George Eales, had come out. And Anita had spilled all the beans about something that was known, but not known to everybody, and that is that she had been a hardcore junkie for about 13 years.
Oh, yeah.
Had also suffered the right word? She embraced addiction for her entire life. She was hardly sober for a day from, I would say, her mid-teens until almost the end of her life. And so at that time, Anita did a lot of high-profile interviews, and everybody fast-forwarded to drugs. This really bugged her, because she was an artist. She
right.
was a great artist. She was a revolutionary jazz singer who created a style that nobody before her had done. And it is imitated to this day, and it was the epitome of cool jazz, meaning that her singing had a kind of a blasé affect to it.
Mm.
There was a whole school of cool jazz, of course, in Anita's era epitomized by Miles Davis and Chet Baker and all the guys on the West Coast, Jerry Mulligan and so forth. And the idea of it was detached. It was not hot and intense and fiery. It was more blithe and cool, and it had this attitude of kind of not caring, being above it all.
Yeah.
But the ones who really did it great, and Anita was one, and Chet Baker, whom I also wrote a book about, was another. And what made that style work, in my opinion, is that you saw cool and you heard cool, and underneath that you sensed something that was really burning, that was mostly concealed, but you could sense it. And Anita, God, she was such a marvelous hodgepodge of conflicting qualities, because she led this tempestuous life. She was in prison. She was she was spending all her money on dope. She was an alcoholic at various points in her life, and yet, when we think of Anita, when we see her in our mind's eye, she had a 500 kilowatt smile, big, beautiful, white, toothy smile. She was upbeat on stage. She was funny. She had a brightness about her. She was not a tragic image like Billie Holiday was. We think of Billie Holiday, we think of tragedy. We think of Anita, we think of brightness and swing and fun.
There's a great quote in your book that from Anita: if you don't like the way I'm singing, the way I sing, go listen to Patti Page.
I love that.
I love that quote. Now, you know,
well, for Anita,
that's a classic way. Anita, after reading your book.
Well, I will say that I like Patti Page for what she did, but Patti Page sang songs exactly the same way every time she sang them. And Anita didn't do anything the same way twice. And when you referenced the jazz life earlier, which is a fascinating notion to me about a life that, about a way of improvising your life, both in music and out of music. A lot of that is tied in with drugs, by the way, because junkies had to, their goal was to stay high, because they had to. Once they were hooked, they were hooked. And you are scuffling for money. You are in strange towns. You have to keep getting high, and so you have to go to enormous lengths in order to do. You will do anything to get high. So Anita made up her day every day. She had engagements, but otherwise she spent an awful lot of her time doing what junkies must do to stay high. And so everything about her was improvisational. Even when she gave interviews, Anita gave sensational interviews for the most part, unless she hated you. And I can cite a couple of examples of interviewers that really peed her off. But Anita listened intently to interviews. She would be, if she and not I were on the other end of this phone, she would be listening carefully to every word you say and really thinking about it before she answered. And she was Irish, so she had a lot of blarney in her, and she didn't let the truth stand in the way of a great story. But she would give you a carefully thought out answer. She was with you. It was the same, interviewing her in a way was the same as probably as being with her on stage. When you see video of Anita, she's listening to everything that's happening around her, running the band, because, and this is another very interesting thing about Anita, she came along in the 1930s. When she sang with a bunch of guys, she was calling the shots. And it was a fascinating thing to see. Every song that she sang, she would count off. She would tell the musicians what she wanted them to do. She would stop them if it was wrong. She was ahead of her time in so many ways.
As you write in the book, it still is difficult to get to the real Anita, because she never let her guard down, and she never let down her image. So there was a whole, she had a self-mythology that she was very invested in. And she would tell stories in a certain way, like her relationship with Judy Garland, for instance. Now that was...
I went to see her in the late 80s. I used to go to a jazz club in New York that I loved called Fat Tuesdays. Loved jazz. Fat Tuesday, seeing jazz at Fat Tuesdays. And at the end of one show, I remember it like it was yesterday, her drummer, Danny D'Imperio, whom I interviewed for my book, Anita would, in the course of the show, give Danny a long solo and would walk over to the bar and have a drink. This is in the middle of a song, and talk to people at the bar as though, not as though she were Anita O'Day, but just as though they were the people she happened to be sitting at the next bar stool from. Danny's on stage playing. She walked back when she felt like it. So then for the rest of the show, she would be really well lubricated. And at the end of the show, the dressing room of Fat Tuesdays was, it was a long, narrow room. The dressing room was all the way back in the corner, and anybody could go in. And Anita would often be hanging out outside the dressing room. And I remember walking up to her, mentioning my friend Charlie Cochran, a wonderful pianist singer, more of a cabaret pianist singer, who had been a buddy of hers for years. And she launched into, without prompting, the entire story of how she and Judy Garland found themselves staying in Charlie's apartment in New York together, both his house guests. He was away. I remember her saying, she said, hold out your hand. So I held out my hand, and then she shook my hand in an absolutely limp, dead handshake. Oh, yeah, and she said that was Judy Garland's hand.
Wow.
So I get goosebumps as I tell you these things, because since my book came out, so many people have told me about experiences they had with Anita O'Day. Even going to see her once, even having a little brief word with her after a show, everybody who met her came away with a story.
But those stories that she tells, like, how many abortions did she have?
Oh, Anita, again, Anita exaggerated a lot. Maybe she gave all kinds of wacky numbers, and then the numbers would change from telling to telling. I certainly think she had a few. I don't think she had 13 or 21.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My special guest tonight is James Gavin. Always a pleasure to talk to him. He's written a number of critically acclaimed books about jazz and vocal artists, but tonight we're talking about his latest, Cool Heat, Anita O'Day and Her Dangerous Jazz Life. I want to talk a little bit about her childhood. She was born Anita Bell Lena Colton. Her childhood was rough, and I don't want to get into all the details that you have in the book. One of the things that I became, wow, she was really into dance marathons for a bit, and that toughens you up.
The dance marathon part of Anita's story is fascinating. She loved to talk about it.
Wow.
As your listeners know, in the days of the Depression, when people were fighting for their lives, dance marathons, walkathons, dance-a-thons, they were all basically the same thing. They were a way to make money if you were really good during those dark Depression years. They would normally be in a dance hall. There would be an orchestra present, and all these contestants would vie for who could stay on their feet dancing for the longest. It was the endurance test of all endurance tests. And Anita needed money, and she signed up, and she did about a half a dozen of them. She never won, which bugged her, because she never stopped talking about the fact that she would not quite make first place, but she would come close. So for the rest of her life, when she sang, she compared the two things in her head. For her, a song was a race to the finish.
Right.
it was a contest with herself and with her musicians to see who could come out first. When she made a great album, everybody that I know loves it, with Oscar Peterson on Verve Records in the mid-50s, Anita felt that she had lost 12 out of 12 races because Oscar was just playing every key on that piano all the time and was more or less oblivious to the fact that it was Anita's album. And it burned her. It probably reminded her of the dance-a-thon days when she came close but no cigar. In any case, I disagree with her because I think that it's a fantastic performance on both their parts. But Anita was very tough on herself. And also, now that I mention it, Anita was astonishingly low on ego. She used to say, "This is my daily work. This is what I do." When people were gaga in her presence and effusing about how much they loved her, she would just look at them, and I was a couple of times one of those people, she would just look at us as if we were strange. She didn't understand the whole notion of star worship.
Yeah.
I love that about her.
Now, there's so much in this book. I just want to hit a few points before we run out of time, because we could do hours on this book. I want to talk about a couple of names. Roy Eldridge, the trumpeter. Talk to me about Anita and Roy.
Anita and Roy Eldridge. Roy Eldridge was one of the great swing trumpeters. Some people spoke of him as a link between Louis Armstrong and Dizzy Gillespie.
Yeah,
he was a high-voltage, exciting, high-note trumpeter who just sizzled. He had so much electricity in his playing. And he and Anita were with the Gene Krupa Orchestra at the same time, and they made swing history with a song called Let Me Off Uptown, which was about exploring the joys of Harlem. And what's interesting about that record is that, which was a big hit in the 40s, is that here's a white girl telling a black dude a thing or two about Harlem. Anita didn't, I don't think until years later, until some people brought up the unusualness of that, I don't think that it ever occurred to Anita that there was anything strange about it. There was friction between her and Roy. Roy felt that Anita was a steam sealer, in that every time he was at the microphone, every time he had a solo moment, she wasn't just standing there or sitting on a chair the way girl jazz singers, band singers rather, in those days would, being polite and unnoticeable. She was an entertainer when she sang. It's so much fun to watch her because she danced, she gestured, she smiled. You couldn't take your eyes off Anita. So if you were on a stage with Anita, whoever else it was would not be seen.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, I want to talk about this too. I mean, there's so many things I want to talk about. But was Anita's transition from the big band era to bebop?
Oh, yes.
And that's an interesting transition.
I'm happy to say, Mark, that one of the musicians who taught her bebop is still alive. He's close to 100. His name is Gene DeNovi, a wonderful pianist now based in Toronto. And I would term him the second oldest living bebopper, the first of which is my friend Terry Gibbs, the great vibraphonist, who is going on 102, living in the San Fernando Valley.
But I mean, for Anita, it seemed like from your book, it was just another challenge that she had to master.
Yes, and she knew that this was a new musical language that had to be learned, because I don't think one can overestimate the strangeness of bebop in the mid-late 1940s and how intimidating it was to musicians, a lot of whom looked to Charlie Parker as their guiding star, and because Charlie Parker was a heroin addict, lots of them. Terry Gibbs will tell you this. He never did it, by the way, but he all around him, he saw musicians who thought that in order to play that way, it must be the dope. Anyway, and ultimately, Anita went down that road a few years later.
Better than but sex, Anita, that's what she said.
It's what she did. But Anita set about learning the language of bebop very meticulously. And starting in about 1947-48, she made her first bebop recordings. Mm. And bebop was hard enough for musicians, but for singers to learn how to speak the language of bebop was really tough. And she was one of a handful who could do it. So for the rest of her life, really, her singing was very bebop inspired. She would often say that she only had a little over an octave to sing with. She had a very limited number of notes. So she had to find all the notes that were between the cracks. Bebop enabled her to do that.
I want to talk about her appearance in the film Jazz on a Summer's Day. It's a film documentary on the Newport Jazz Festival, July 6th, 1958. She is the image that, and it's the image on the cover of her book. Her look at that in that film and on that day in the festival just cemented her presence in so many people's minds.
It is her iconic look.
But wasn't the look that she had up until that point?
She looked quite ladylike. It was a garden party look that she created for herself from scratch.
Yeah.
Walked into a boutique, a big black pinwheel hat trimmed with ostrich feathers and an elegant black cocktail dress and gloves.
Covered up her tracks.
That's what she told us all proudly a million times. Yeah, it was very clever.
And but, I mean, this is a very purposeful look from her.
She was in control artistically every step of the way. She was not one of the featured performers in that she didn't get one of the primetime spots. She was like more during cocktail hour and the sun was shining outside in Newport. And she wanted to make an impression. She wanted to make the most of the 45 minutes that she had at the microphone for that particular set that was filmed. And so she created a look. She walked into a boutique. She looked around. She pointed at the hat. She saw the dress. The gloves were her own find. And that image has lingered in a lot of people's minds because knowing what we later learned about the realities of Anita's life, she was 5 years into being this severe junkie. And her life, apart from what happened on the stage, was a shambles in a lot of ways. And yet there she was, the essence of cool control on stage.
It's an amazing image. I remember even before I knew who she was and I saw that film, I came away with that image.
I think, for all the giants that are in that masterpiece of a documentary, we seem to envision Anita as the cover girl for that film.
There's so many interesting... First of all, she had several disastrous marriages. Mm-hmm. A lot of affairs. She seems to have gravitate towards marrying gay men.
The first one probably.
What the hell?
The second, I think it was just another challenge for Anita.
The first marriage was crazy.
She went for challenges. I know a number of the aforementioned gay men. I've met a couple of them are dear friends of mine to this day. It was, and they began by worshiping my friends Joe Sardero and Charlie Cochran. They began by worshiping Anita as an artist. They loved what she did, and so they wanted to get to know her better. But they wound up getting more than they bargained for. So they both had to demur when Anita put it to them. In Joe's case, more than one time. But those friendships lasted for a long time.
Well, she had a friendship with John Pietranowicz. And that was a fascinating relationship because it went on for decades. But it was nothing more than a friendship, I guess.
He was a big Anita fan, and he was a private in during World War II. And I have the letters that he and Anita. I don't have. I have Anita's letters to him, and that she wrote to him mostly in the 1940s. And they're really sweet. I love Joe Sardaro inherited them, and he shared them with me. And they show those letters a sweet, normal side of Anita that she didn't normally show the world. She gave the world the Anita O'Day that they were expecting. But with Joe, she was a normal girl with normal concerns, and she had a real sweetness and a real passion about her. Anita had many conflicting sides to her. That's what makes her so fascinating.
Did the heroin ever? How did heroin affect her voice?
Not at all. The effect that I can detect is that her pitch became a little, shall we say, lazier in the 1950s. But Anita being Anita, she used that. One of the characteristics of West Coast cool jazz in those days was a certain, shall we say, relaxed approach to pitch, because it implied a relaxation. It implied a languor, and it also implied a certain detachment that became a stylistic part of that sound.
Wow.
And I would rather hear someone sing or play in tune than out of tune. But there are a handful of artists that really made that sound work. And Anita's pitch, as she grew older, went more off the tracks than this. But let's, for example,
we're out of time. James.
Oh no, I haven't even talked about Anita and Verve Records, on which she made jazz singing history.
That's why people have to buy the book. James, always be selling. Always be selling.
I loved it. Thank you so much.
I mean, seriously, there's so much in this book. We could do a weekly show just about this. And there's a lot, and so much juicy stuff too. My guest tonight has been James Gavin. He's written a number of critically acclaimed books about jazz and vocal artists. And tonight we've been talking one of his best, Cool Heat, Anita O'Day and Her Dangerous Jazz Life. James, it's a pleasure as always.
A joy always. Thank you so much, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.
What do you mean, Joe? My name's Roy.
Well, come here, Roy, and get groovy. You been uptown?
No, I ain't been uptown, but I've been around.
You mean to say you ain't been uptown?
No, I ain't been uptown. What's uptown?
If it's pleasure you're about, and you feel like stepping out, all you've got to shout is, let me off uptown.